KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
In the search effort. The American Gaming Association says nearly $1.5 billion in legal bets are expected to be placed during Sunday's Super Bowl game between the Philadelphia Eagles and the Kansas City Chiefs. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports with the game just days away, health experts are warning about the dangers and the problems of gambling.
Daniel Kotsias is a sports gambling counselor from Oak Park, Michigan. He says the use of betting on smartphones and iPads makes it easier for people to get hooked.
They had this constant dopamine on tap on their phones where they could just tap into it whenever they wanted to. I'm all for having a kind of mindful regimen in general to how you use your phone, you know, putting your phone in the drawer or leaving it in the car at certain points in the day just to kind of manage those urges.
A survey by LendingTree shows more than 4 in 10 Super Bowl watchers say they plan to bet $100 or more on Sunday's game. The study also showed that men are more than twice as likely as women to place wagers. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 77 points, NASDAQ down 127. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, the debate over federal education policy flares up in Congress.
We're going to start with a bird's eye view of President Trump's third week back in the White House.
We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal. And I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy. But the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad. This could be so magnificent.
Besides the plan he revealed for Gaza, Trump is attempting to overhaul the federal workforce and end diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and another thing or two or ten. Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Domenico, you have a new analysis on NPR.org this morning that breaks down by day everything that happened this week. And it's incredible just how much did happen. But I take it this is not random. I take it that this is a strategy.
Yeah, I mean, it's by design. I mean, it's been a philosophy of Trump's and the people around him for years. Here's former Trump advisor Steve Bannon speaking to PBS's Frontline in 2019.
All we have to do is flood the zone. Every day we hit them with three things. They'll bite on one and we'll get all of our stuff done. Bang, bang, bang. These guys will never be able to recover. But we got to start with muzzle velocities.
So that's the idea. Get it all out there as fast as possible so that some things maybe slide by. There's only so much the media can cover and the public can consume. In the first 3 weeks of the Trump presidency, the second term have certainly lived up to that idea.
Well, yeah, just to review, there have been dozens of executive orders and lots of cabinet appointees who are getting through, ready to carry, despite the fact that many of them are very controversial, despite, you know, and they're ready to carry out what Trump wants done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's getting his people in place. Even Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's up for health secretary, and Tulsi Gabbard for director of national intelligence. They look like they're on their way to being confirmed to those positions, despite what have been bipartisan concerns. We also saw Pam Bondi confirmed for attorney general just hours after she was sworn in. She set up a group to review the work related to the cases that were brought up against President Trump.
We also saw Trump announce tariffs against Canada and Mexico and then immediately delay them a month.
Yeah, 25% tariffs were supposed to go into effect on them this week, but Trump said he was delaying those to work out deals with them on immigration, fentanyl, and trade. 10% tariffs on China did go into effect, though. This whole thing, though, showed that this new way that the U.S. is going to be operating on the world stage under Trump, you know, trying to get what he sees as the best deal in a short-term transactional way, even with allies. And that's to say nothing of Trump's continued attempt to expand America's footprint, this time, you know, saying he wants ownership of Gaza, something that allies and stakeholders in the region, by the way, have said is a complete non-starter.
And then there is what Trump and Elon Musk are trying to do with the federal workforce and shrink the size of government. What do we learn about Musk's efforts?
Yeah, it's been a real whirlwind here in D.C. DOGE, this informal Department of Government Efficiency, has been at multiple agencies accessing records, including sensitive payment information at the Treasury Department. And there's this effort to get federal workers to resign by, quote, deferred resignation, essentially a buyout.
Which a judge yesterday moved the deadline from yesterday at midnight to Monday.
Right. And the administration has pushed very hard to shut down USAID, which is responsible for doling out about half of U.S. foreign aid.
Finally, let me ask you about the administration's battle against DEI policies. What steps did it take this week?
Yeah, Trump signed an executive order banning transgender athletes from participating in girls and women's sports. The NCAA said that it'll adjust to the order. But I want to play this exchange between Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, and NCAA President Charlie Baker, who's a former Republican governor from Massachusetts, from a hearing earlier this month for some context.
How many athletes are there in the United States in NCAA schools?
510,000.
How many transgender athletes are you aware of?
Less than 10.
So Durbin went on to stress that number, less than 10 out of 510,000. Yet it's become in many ways a cultural touchstone of the 2024 campaign. There were other efforts this week, like photos of women and minorities at the National Cryptologic Museum that were covered up. Those were later removed after public outcry. It's really a push to systematically remove any idea that diversity and multiculturalism are good things in this country. Conservatives have long viewed the culture in the country as moving too far in a liberal direction, and they're certainly trying to change all of that now.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Michelle.
Some big companies are literally erasing diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI.
GM, Pepsi, Disney, and others have scrubbed some or all of those words from their annual reports to investors.
NPR business correspondent Maria Aspen is the first to report this. Maria, tell us what you found.
Hey, good morning. So as you know, we've been seeing some big companies announcing for months that they're ending or changing their DEI programs. They include Walmart, Target, Amazon, and just this week, Google told employees that it's ending its hiring targets for underrepresented workers. But what I discovered this week is that many more big companies are backing away from the language of DEI without making a big announcement. I went digging into the new annual reports that companies have been publishing for their investors, and I compared them with what they were saying a year ago. And I found that this year, at least a dozen big companies have all deleted or softened the language they use to talk about diversity. These companies include GM, Intel, Disney, Pepsi, and Chipotle. Now, some of these companies wouldn't talk about these changes with me, so we don't know for sure why they've done this. We just know that they've stopped talking about DEI in public. But some of the companies did give me some clues.
Ooh, all right, what do they tell you?
Well, there's a lot going on, but a few of these companies referred specifically to President Trump's new executive orders ending DEI in the federal government. These orders also threaten to sanction private companies that are federal contractors that have what Trump called illegal DEI programs. And Google, for example, is a federal contractor. A spokesperson this week told me that Google is evaluating the changes required by Trump's executive orders, and Google, I should note, is one of NPR's funders. Another company I talked to was 3M. It's that big conglomerate that makes Post-it notes and chemicals and a bunch of other stuff. It's also a federal contractor. 3M also deleted some references to diversity from its latest annual report, and a spokesperson specifically mentioned the executive orders when he talked to me.
Yeah, but not every company that's making these changes is a federal contractor. I mean, so what else is happening here?
So Trump's executive orders are definitely adding to the pressure, but corporate America was already facing a lot of pressure from critics of DEI who say that it is itself discriminatory. The bigger picture here is just that big companies are pretty risk averse. I talked about this with Becky Baker, who's an employment lawyer with Finson & Elkins. She says that DEI was a really popular buzzword in corporate America 5 years ago, but now it's kind of politically toxic.
We have seen companies start to decide that, you know, the reward in doing so is not necessarily outweighed by the risk anymore.
So she's not surprised by the changes all of these companies are making, and she's expecting us to see a lot more.
So is this the end of DEI?
Yes and no. There are still some companies that are standing by their promises to pursue diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they're still talking about it using those words. For example, Costco said in its most recent annual report that promoting DEI is part of taking care of its employees. And meanwhile, some of the people doing this work tell me that they hope that most companies are going to continue making their workplaces more inclusive for all employees, even if they're not using words and phrases like DEI.
All right, that's NPR's Maria Aspen. Thanks a lot, Maria.
Thank you.
As we've been reporting, President Trump wants to close the U.S. Department of Education and help families pay for private schooling. Democrats are trying to figure out how to stop him. Earlier this week, the House Education Committee held its first meeting of this new congressional term. And as NPR's Corey Turner reports, the nation's partisan differences exploded into the open.
The meeting was called the State of American Education. But the only thing lawmakers could agree on was that it's not good.
In K-12 education, there's much work that needs to be done.
The committee's new Republican chairman, Tim Walberg of Michigan, mentioned the recent dispiriting results from a national assessment.
Students are still scoring at lower levels in math and reading than they were in 2019.
I spent 40 years in the classroom, 40 years.
North Carolina Democrat Alma Adams.
And I'll tell you right now that the way things are going, we're failing our children.
What Democrats and Republicans could not agree on was why and what to do about it. Republican Bob Onder of Missouri argued the Biden Education Department pushed liberal politics over learning.
Kids are learning about the 15 latest genders, but not how to do multiplication, division.
The Education Department cannot dictate what's taught in classrooms, but under Biden, it did briefly expand protections for transgender students. Onder and several Republicans said they back Trump's efforts to dismantle the department.
And I believe abolishing the Department of Education is definitely a big part of the solution.
But Democrats on the committee were outraged. Mark Takano of California argued President Trump doesn't have the power to dramatically cut the department, let alone close it. Only Congress can do that.
This hearing is called the State of American Education. But from what I'm seeing from the other side's behavior is that it really should be called the Republican surrender to a would-be king.
The hearing grew testy when it came to the question of whether the federal government should help families pay for private schools. Utah Republican Burgess Owens said he backs giving parents as much choice as possible.
As a parent, I know what's best for my kid, and I would think everybody in this room would feel the same way. You would do everything you could to get out your child out of a failing school system.
But witness Janae Nelson, the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, decried the renewed resistance to public education and invoked the former governor of Alabama, who famously demanded segregation forever.
This massive resistance 2.0 seeks to achieve what George Wallace and his extremist acolytes could not: the hoarding of public resources to fund private education for a privileged few at the expense of the many.
The fight will begin all over again next week when senators hear from Linda McMahon, President Trump's pick to run and potentially close the U.S. Department of Education. Corey Turner, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interviews with singer Marianne Faithfull, who was discovered at a Rolling Stones party in 1964, recorded As Tears Go By Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and later became Jagger's girlfriend. After drug addiction and homelessness, she bounced back to become a smoky-voiced interpreter of dark, moody songs. Join us. I sit down.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. All right, quiz time. Not which came first, but which cost more, the chicken or the egg? Egg prices have been going through the roof as a stubborn outbreak of avian flu haunts the nation's egg chickens. But luckily for football fans, of Super Bowl weekend, the price of chicken meat has barely budged. NPR Scott Horsley has our story on the chicken and the egg.
Sam Krause is a sixth-generation farmer whose family's been in the egg business for more than half a century. He and his brother oversee a flock of 14 million laying hens in four states. Krause not only sells a lot of eggs, he also likes to eat them.
Absolutely, two eggs every single morning. I'm a dad of young kids, so it's usually two hard-boiled eggs on my way out the door.
Krause's birds have not been directly affected by the avian flu, thanks to good luck and millions of dollars worth of sanitary precautions. But nationwide, egg farmers lost more than 38 million birds to the flu last year, nearly 14 million in December alone. That's put a crack in the nation's egg supply, which shows no sign of easing. Krause says when a flock of egg-laying hens is wiped out, it takes 6 months to a year to recover.
Egg farmers are in the fight of their lives to keep this disease at bay, to keep our hens safe, and to keep eggs coming. We know it's frustrating for consumers who want to go and buy eggs at the prices they've been used to.
But even as egg prices have more than doubled in the last year, chicken wing prices remain grounded. In fact, they're slightly below their five-year average. Chickens raised for meat, known as broilers, live on different farms than those that produce eggs. And while broiler chickens are not immune from bird flu, Tom Super of the American Chicken Council says they haven't been hit nearly as hard as their egg-laying cousins.
They're younger, typically, and older birds are more susceptible to the virus. And broiler chickens are also not on the farm as long, only about 7 weeks.
That short life cycle also means when a flock of broilers is lost to the flu, they can be replaced fairly quickly. So while some supermarkets are now rationing eggs, and Waffle House added a 50-cent per egg surcharge this week, chicken wings remain abundant and fairly affordable heading into Super Bowl weekend. That's good because Tom Super projects Americans will gobble up nearly 1.5 billion wings on game day, 20 million more than this time last year.
They're just a great group social food. The spicier, the buffalo wings, they pair very well with a nice cold beer.
Buffalo wings take their name from Buffalo, New York, where the Anchor Bar helped popularize the spicy snack decades ago. Sales might have been even stronger this year had the Buffalo Bills gone all the way, but the Bills lost the conference championship game to the Kansas City Chiefs, who will face off Sunday against the Philadelphia Eagles. A lot of Eagles fans will get their wings at the Jug Handle Inn, which consistently scores near the top of the pecking order among Philadelphia wing shops. Jug Handle owner Kevin Stone expects to do a brisk takeout business on Sunday.
We start cooking at like 7, 8 a.m. and then go up until game time. I think for the last Super Bowl, we did around 23, 25,000 wings.
Stone's been working with his chicken wholesaler and says there should be plenty of wings to go around this weekend. Just keep your eye on the play clock.
Don't wait until 2 o'clock the day of to try to call for 3 o'clock. Get your orders in early.
And one more bargain for your Super Bowl table. The price of celery, often served alongside chicken wings, is down more than 8% from a year ago. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's Friday, which means it's time for StoryCorps. Dan May Jr.'s parents divorced when he was 5 years old. Life during the week was often difficult, but weekends brought relief. He and his sister would go to stay at his grandmother's house.
My grandmother, she understood that because my parents weren't together, I was helping to raise my younger sister. And although I was still a kid, I had more responsibilities than I probably should have. That was very much a hard time. But when we would get to her house, she would kind of give me that gentle nudge of, hey, you don't have to be an adult right now. And I would go straight to her bedroom and grab this music box. It was white porcelain. It had golden highlights and it played Fascination by Nat King Cole. I would wind this box up. I would turn it on. I would rock in this rocking chair. And that was the beginning of the weekend of adventure with Grandma. Every moment in that weekend was together, back in picnics, throwing balls, swimming for hours. And she was the one who taught us how to swim. And Grandma, I know for a fact, was the very first one to know that I was gay. She would always give me this look and say, Danny, I think you should maybe play the field. It was attention that I maybe didn't get from any other adult in my life. Those weekends were everything. February 2021, she passed away. I wasn't able to get down to see her, but my cousin called me and I got to talk to her. And I said, if you're ready to go, it's okay. And she died the next day. My cousins packed up her property, drove all the way to Ohio, get to our house, start unloading the car. The rocking chair comes out. It smelled like Grandma. I sat down in it. And then the music box comes out. And sitting in our driveway, playing this music box, I felt very lonely. But I'm grateful. When I listen to the music box, I think about a time when life wasn't easy, but she made it lighter.
Dan May Jr., remembering his grandmother, Donna May, whose music box you're listening to right now. Dan first told his story in a voicemail he left for the StoryCorps podcast. If you have a story to share, leave a voicemail at storycorps.org/hotline.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial. Pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru, who along with its retailers is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company.
This is NPR News.
President Trump began his second term with a dramatic crackdown on immigration. His critics call these plans cruel and unnecessary, but many of his supporters are applauding these early steps.
We are thankful that Donald Trump is taking action against illegal immigration.
I'm Elsa Chang. Trump supporters talk about his early immigration policies on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Labor Department says the U.S. economy added 143,000 jobs in January, reflecting a slowdown in hiring. Healthcare, retail, and government reported the largest job gains. The nation's jobless rate edged lower to 4%. More than 60,000 federal employees have accepted the Trump administration's offer of deferred resignation. However, a federal judge is temporarily blocking the program. He's pushing back the deadline for workers to decide whether to accept the offer to at least Monday afternoon. That's when the judge is scheduled to hear arguments on legal challenges by unions representing federal workers. Chanda Loader is one of those who took the offer. She says there's a lot of uncertainty right now with the courts involved.
We just don't know if we're getting paid, if we're not getting paid, if we're going to be working through September, if those who aren't taking it are going to be laid off.
Labor unions believe the deferred resignations are illegal. Democratic members of the House Education and Workforce Committee are outside the Department of Education building in Washington this morning, pressing Trump to leave it open.
We are demanding that the acting secretary meet with us and agree. Donald Trump and Elon Musk must not and will not destroy the Department of Education.
That's California Congressman Mark Takano. This is NPR News. President Trump is placing sanctions on the International Criminal Court in The Hague. They stem from the ICC's investigations into Israel and subsequent arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The court accuses Netanyahu of war crimes for the way in which his military has responded to the October 7th attack in southern Israel carried out by Hamas. That attack sparked the war in Gaza. The ICC is denouncing the move by Trump as are countries including Canada, France, and Germany. Lab-grown meat in pet foods is now on store shelves in Britain, where it was first legalized last year. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
The manufacturer is called Meatly, and its product is called Chick Bites, but it contains neither meat nor chicken. It's made from a single sample of cells from one chicken egg, then cultivated in a lab and combined with plant-based ingredients. The London company behind it calls it a tasty, low-carbon, healthy protein source, at least for dogs. Lab-grown meat is seen as more ethical and sustainable. But a recent poll showed only about a third of Britons would eat it themselves, while nearly half of them would feed it to their pets. Another Austrian-American company is developing lab-grown mouse meat for cats and dogs. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Lots of people are feeling pretty crummy these days as the winter stew of respiratory viruses simmers.
But there are a couple of unusual trends driving all the coughing, sneezing, and fevers this year.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now to explain. So, Rob, what's happening out there with all these viruses?
Well, A, this is kind of a good news, bad news story. Let's start with the good news. This winter's COVID surge looks like the mildest since the virus first emerged. Here's Caitlin Rivers. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins.
This year's winter wave is low compared to previous winters. This is the smallest winter wave we've had since the pandemic began.
There are still plenty of people getting it and even ending up in the hospital or worse. So Rivers says people shouldn't let down their guard.
Now, when it comes to COVID, though, I mean, why is this winter's COVID wave, I mean, so mild?
Well, one possible explanation is that we went through an unusually intense summer COVID surge that also started relatively late. So lots of people may still have some immunity from when they had COVID this summer, and no new variant has evolved that's any better about getting around the immunity people have built up. There's also a theory called viral interference. That's when the presence of one virus kind of pushes out other viruses. Here's Aubrey Gordon. She's an epidemiologist at the University of Michigan.
It's possible that viral interference is playing a role this year. There's a lot of influenza circulating. It may generate some non-specific immunity, so some non-specific protection, which then prevents people from getting other respiratory viruses like SARS-CoV-2. It sort of crowds it out.
Now, you probably noticed she said there's a lot of flu out there, and that brings us to the bad news.
Yeah, the flu. So tell us what's up with the flu.
Well, this year's flu season started unusually early and has been pretty intense, and now it looks like we're getting hit by a second winter surge of flu. Here's Caitlin Rivers again from Johns Hopkins.
Influenza activity first peaked around the turn of the new year, late December, early January. Activity then declined for several weeks in a row, which is usually a sign that the season is on its way out. But then it really took an unusual turn and started to rise again. So activity is now at a second peak, just as high as it was around the turn of the new year.
So it's looking like the intensity of this year's flu season could have a long tail.
So, Rob, any idea why this is happening? I mean, I'm going to try and connect two things that might not have anything to do with each other. Could it have anything to do with the bird flu?
No, which is good news. So far, testing hasn't spotted any signs that the worrying bird flu that's infecting dairy cows and poultry is spreading widely in people. So it's a bit of a mystery. It could just be kind of natural variation that happens with the flu. That said, the more people who catch the flu, the greater the chances that people could get infected with both viruses, the regular flu and bird flu, and that could give the bird flu the opportunity to kind of swap genes with the regular flu and evolve into something more dangerous, even potentially cause another pandemic.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thanks.
You bet.
President Trump says he wants control of Greenland because it's crucial for America's national security. It's also crucial for science. An ice core, a cylinder of ice drilled out of a glacier decades ago, helps us understand climate change. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports.
Last year, NASA scientists aboard a small jet above the Greenland ice sheet were testing a sophisticated form of radar. It picked up something mysterious, crumpled structures about 100 feet under the surface.
It's sort of the ground zero or birthplace of ice core drilling and in some ways paleoclimate research as a whole.
That's glaciologist William Colgan, a professor at the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland. He's talking about an abandoned military base called Camp Century, which has a notorious Cold War history, but also a pivotal place in the history of science. The camp was so unusual, it needs some explaining. It was built under the ice, about 150 miles inland. In a stroke of Cold War creativity, the U.S. Army wanted to test whether a base under the ice, hidden from the view of the Soviets, was feasible.
Today, Camp Century is being operated as a year-round Arctic research center. As part of man's efforts to probe deeper and deeper into the secrets of the universe, an elaborate program of tests and experiments is being carried out.
An Army video from 1964. Some of those tests were top secret. Christian Nielsen teaches science history at Aarhus University in Denmark.
Alongside the main tunnels of Camp Century, or a bit removed, there was a semicircular tunnel where they installed railroad tracks.
It was a project that would have hidden 600 nuclear missiles, rail lines to move them, and up to 11,000 troops, all in thousands of miles of tunnels under the ice cap. The idea was eventually abandoned, as was Camp Century. But one of the experiments performed there has been key for climate science. An ice core nearly a mile long drilled at Camp Century gave scientists the first lengthy and detailed record of the Earth's climate. Again, glaciologist William Colgan.
So before the Camp Century core, we did not really have a reliable way of looking into the Earth's past climate. When the U.S. pulled out the Camp Century core in 1966, it provided a window into the past like people had never known before.
Instead of relying on, say, a century or so of data on weather, we now had records all the way back beyond the last glacial period.
And I think it was a real change in how people think about Earth's history and climate history. When they published the core record, they used the phrase 1,000 centuries of climate record from Camp Century, because I don't think people are used to thinking in millennia.
He still travels there about once a year to run tests and service instruments that are gathering data. Because various kinds of research there were started so early, the site remains important.
It's sort of become a science super site on the ice sheet, because of the deep core record that was pulled out of there and the other measurements that were made in the 60s, people keep coming back and resurveying things against these baseline measurements.
Those instruments are in some sense all that remains of Camp Century, which, as the NASA flight found, has been buried ever deeper under decades of snow and ice.
Of course, when you go to the site today, you don't see anything. It looks like any other site on the ice sheet, just flat white snow and a blue sky.
But Colgan, who knows the history of the ice there, can see things. He says the Army picked the site in part because the surface ice never melted, what's called dry snow, which is easier to dig into. Now, though, the scientists have noticed that it melts a little almost every year. Camp Century's ice is still talking to us 60 years later. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
Democrats are trying to push back on the world's richest man, Elon Musk, and his efforts to gut the federal workforce. The Week in Politics, next time on Here and Now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust, live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, May Martinez. Basketball Hall of Fame coach Pat Riley is cashing in on three-peat again. He trademarked the term in the late 80s after his LA Lakers won back-to-back NBA championships. Alas, they never won three in a row. Now, though, the Kansas City Chiefs have struck a deal with Riley to use the term if they win a third straight Super Bowl on Sunday. Royalties go to the Riley Family Foundation. Hey, Siri, set a reminder to trademark four-peat, you know, just in case. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The United States has a new ambassador, not to a country, but for children's books. The Library of Congress has named Mac Barnett its National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. So what does this job actually do? Well, NPR's Andrew Limbong spoke with Barnett to find out.
Here's how Mac Barnett described the gig.
It's a lofty title, yeah. You know, the shorthand that I've been saying is it is like the poet laureate of children's books.
I don't know if that's necessarily shorthand, but essentially the job is to promote books and reading to kids across the country. Everyone who gets the job does it a little differently, and Barnett's focus will be on picture books.
The picture book is my favorite art form. I started out, I was a camp counselor in college, and reading picture books out loud to kids, that is what made me want to start writing books for them. It's just such an incredible, vibrant, exciting, forward-looking, experimental art form. And I think it's really undervalued, too.
Barnett is the author of dozens of books for young people. Some novels, some graphic novels, and yes, some picture books, including his popular Shapes trilogy, which has its own series on Apple TV+. But the picture book, he says, doesn't get the same respect as those other forms, which he finds, frankly, offensive.
I'm not offended because it's dismissing my work. It's because we're dismissing kids. And if we think that children's books are anything less than real literature, it's because we think kids are something less than real people. And if we believe they are real people, then they deserve good art.
And Barnett argues that good art for kids should be held as highly in our culture as any other literature.
You're saying like you'd put like Llama Llama Red Pajama up against Great Gatsby.
I would put Frog and
Toad. I don't mean that kind of, I don't mean that, like I like actually mean that, yeah.
I would put Frog and Toad up against Great Gatsby. In the Night Kitchen?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Where the Wild Things Are. Freight Train. I think Goodnight Moon is one of the great pieces of American literature of the 20th century.
Of course, this is an argument for the adults. In a lot of ways, convincing kids to pick up a book over a phone or an iPad is harder now than ever. But while us grown-ups worry about declining literacy rates and reading test scores, Barnett says he doesn't think about kids as future adults. He thinks about them as readers now.
We're never going to win the argument that you should read a book because it's good for you. This isn't why kids read. It's our job to make books that kids want to read. And what we're talking about there is not a book as an educational tool or some vector for a lesson that an adult wants to impose upon a kid. Like, the subject of children's literature is life itself. This is art for children.
And a part of showing kids that art is to let them lead the way.
Growing up, my mom would take me to the library every week, and she would let me pick out whatever books I wanted to read. Whatever I pulled off the shelf, that was going to go in our checkout bag. It doesn't mean that she agreed with every book. My mom is a very opinionated woman, in addition to being a very funny woman. And if she didn't like what I was reading, she would talk to me about it.
At his acceptance speech, Barnett said, "It's not an accident that picture books are so experimental, because childhood is experimental." Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
New jobs report and a familiar labor market tale.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot. Learn more about Snapshot at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot not available in California or from all agents.
From Marketplace, I'm Nova Safo in for David Brancaccio. We got the government's latest labor market assessment this morning. The economy added 143,000 jobs in January, below expectations but still solid. Revisions to previous reports were also positive. The unemployment rate ticked lower, now at 4%, and wage growth came in strong at 0.5%. Joining me is Julia Coronado, founder and president of Macro Policy Perspectives. Julia, the headline numbers, do they tell us anything new?
Well, they do confirm that the labor market remains in pretty solid territory. So you noted it's a little below expectations, but we got upward revision to December. Hiring is still pretty broad-based and pretty solid, and it's enough to absorb new entrants in the labor market, and the unemployment rate is low. So pretty much good news.
The numbers are noisy, though, right?
Yes, and we had a big annual revision as part of this report. There's a lot to sort through. Again, stepping back, it looks like after a weak patch last summer, the labor market has stabilized, and it's starting the year in pretty healthy territory.
All right, Julia Coronado of Macro Policy Perspectives. She also teaches at University of Texas, Austin. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Let's do the numbers. Well, a relatively muted response on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down 0.1%. Same thing at S&P 500 index. The NASDAQ Composite Index is down about 0.6%. The 10-year Treasury yield has moved substantially higher, though, at 4.5%. A new Bankrate study finds a vast majority of Americans spend money on a common vice, including alcohol, tobacco, and gambling. There's a generational divide here, Marketplace's Kaylee Wells explains.
Alcohol is the top choice for every generation, but it's most popular among older generations and folks with a higher income. Senior research fellow Christine McDaniel at George Mason University's Mercatus Center says those two stats are related.
There's a bit of an income effect there. Older people tend to be more financially stable, but also just cultural. They just prefer to relax with a glass of wine or cocktail.
Sports betting is not nearly as universal. It's particularly big with people under 30. Half of Gen Zers are spending on online sports betting. That's more than double the percentage of Gen Xers and more than triple the boomers.
There's a lot of evidence that Gen Zers are bigger risk takers with their money.
Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst with Bankrate. He says older generations are likely more debt averse because they lived through the Great Recession.
Gen Zers, on the other hand, came of age at a time when stimulus money was abundant. You know, there were a lot of people that were using their stimulus money to gamble on crypto or sports betting or meme stocks.
Rossman says that vice spending can become a problem when people go into debt to pay for it, which, out of all the vices Bankrate studied, is most common for the sports bettors. I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, offering a nationwide network of billboards and data solutions that help businesses build brand awareness and influence consumer behavior. Billboardsforbusiness.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Last week, President Trump removed two Democratic members from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and one member, Gwen Wilcox, from the National Labor Relations Board. Wilcox is now suing, and her lawsuit could test the limits of presidential power over independent agencies, which oversee everything from stock markets to monetary policy. Some legal experts think that the White House wanted a test case to advance a theory known as the unitary executive. For more, let's turn to Stephen Calabresi, a professor of law at Northwestern University. He's written a book on that subject. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So when you were part of the Reagan White House and the Justice Department then, you helped advance the unitary executive theory and have written extensively about it since. Can you explain what it is and why you support the idea?
The theory of the unitary executive is the theory that the president is the head of the executive branch. He has all of the executive power, and he has the authority to fire subordinates for policy reasons if they disagree with him and if he wants to do so.
Now, this would break, though, with nearly 100 years of legal precedent, as well as laws written by Congress that limit a president's ability to fire. How do you square those two things?
There was a case in 1935, Humphrey's executor, which said that there might be an exception to presidential removal power. In recent years, the U.S. Supreme Court, under Chief Justice Roberts, has construed Humphrey's executor more and more narrowly. And in my view, the court is ready to overrule Humphrey's executor, and I think it should overrule Humphrey's executor. The statutes that Congress has passed that purport to limit presidential removal power are quite simply unconstitutional.
As you know, it's not hard to find legal scholars who strongly disagree with you and the theory you just laid out. Now, what do you say to folks who are concerned about really any president being able to, for example, fire the Federal Reserve chair if the chair of the Federal Reserve doesn't do what the president wants him to do? How would you respond to those concerns?
Well, I think the fact the president has the theoretical power to fire anyone in the executive branch doesn't mean that he will exercise that power or choose to exercise that power. President Trump, for example, has not tried to fire the chair of the Federal Reserve Board, probably in part because doing that would rattle the stock exchange and the securities markets. Congress will push back against the illegitimate firing of subordinate executive officials. And the fact that Congress has not pushed back against the firing of officials that President Trump has done in the last 2 weeks indicates that he's not abusing the firing power.
Stephen Calabresi teaches law at Northwestern University and is a leading scholar of the unitary executive theory. Thank you for coming on our show today.
Thank you for having me.
We also spoke with legal experts critical of unitary executive theory. Find that coverage online at marketplace.org. I'm Novosapo with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.